Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Forecast is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
What sort of future do you think we're heading for? How will we live as we slip into the 21st century?
Welcome to Forecast, episode 110. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Scott Johnson.
And this is the show where we get some smart folks to join us and share their visions of what the future will be like. And we sort of kick it around and see what we think about it and hope that maybe when we end up in the future, it will be as good or better than their visions. Right, Scott?
Honestly, Tom, it's that we are sick of living in the here and now. We're tired of what the old future was because we're living it. We're ready for some new future. And my understanding is we have great guests today to do just that.
You are understanding correctly. Joining us today, Patrick Hester, podcast producer for Functional Nerds, SF Signal, and I Should Be Writing. Welcome, Patrick.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good to have you along. Also joining us, Chris Marquardt, host of the world's longest-running photo podcast, Tips from the Top Floor. Of course, you may hear him on The Tech Guy as well, and maker of Pocket Chris, a photo teacher for your iPhone. Welcome,
podcasters,
Chris.
Podcasters for the win.
Woo! It is. It's a foursome of podcasters. A fearsome foursome. Let's start off with a prediction from one of our listeners. This comes from Airman Wolf. Says, as someone that has recently graduated from Air Force boot camp, I've been giving a lot of thought lately to the advancement of military. So here's my crazy-ass prediction. Within 100 years, there will be no human soldiers in war. Instead, humans will control robots from a distance, and combat effectiveness will be based on how quickly and effectively one person can control multiple robo-soldiers. Sounds like StarCraft. This will ultimately lead to one of two things. Wars will be decided on the financial situations of the country slash state slash whatever and their ability to continually build the robots, or it will lead to a gamification of war with a giant expanse of land set aside as an arena of sorts where the sides will battle until the last robo-soldier is left standing.
Oh, Airman Wolf. I love this prediction. We've had conversations on the show a couple of times about the idea of the gamification, as he puts it, of war. And I'm kind of for this, because it means less dead people, basically. But it does mean perhaps a world where financial, money is shifted to the squeakiest wheel, which in this case would be, you know, constantly maintaining this production of robots and their dominance on the playing field. But I wonder what it would actually sort of be for. It seems like warfare now isn't so much about France wants some more room, so they move next door and take everybody out. It's now parts of the world who hate everybody else who've sort of got it going on, so they're trying to do things that are less than conventional. And I don't see them jumping in and going, oh, yeah, we'll do your robot idea. That sounds great. We'll just fight on a battlefield and people won't get hurt. I don't see that happening. So I struggle whenever this comes up with the transition. Like, where do we make the bridge between the kind of wars we fight now, and very specifically the kind we find the sort we fight right now, like this minute, compared to a day where it's a big walled off space and a big chunk of the desert is designated to giant robots fighting? Tom, I just don't know how we get there.
Sounds like Ender's Game to me. First thing I thought of. Patrick, what do you think of this?
Other than the arena, I don't think it's actually that far fetched. Because if you look at some of the stuff that we're doing now with the unmanned drones, they're sending those in and taking out people from thousands of miles away. So I can see that totally happening. I just don't know about the arena part. I think that given our nature, they're still going to be fighting on front lines, not necessarily in an arena.
Well, and they're still going to kill people, though, right? I mean, so the drones that we do now, somebody controls it from Las Vegas or somewhere in Nevada, base in Nevada. Probably not Las Vegas, but anyway, they control a drone halfway across the world, and that thing zeroes in, takes out a compound or whatever. And in your scenario, it's kind of the same thing, except we've got, say, somebody's got a better technology for these giant robots, and we're sending giant robots in to do this destruction. But still, we're taking other human lives, and so that's kind of where I break down, too. It's like, well, okay, that actually seems like a very realistic thing. That's just an issue of the technology getting better, cheaper, and more, productive. The idea that we would do it... Go ahead.
I don't think we're looking at big robots here. This really reminds me of a book that I read by Stanislav Lem, and I think the title, and he probably wrote that like 50 years ago, and the title is Weapon Systems of the 21st Century, and he puts up that picture of swarms of very small autonomous soldiers, basically, flying through the air and fighting that out as swarms, as intelligent swarms. So they basically take people out of the equation.
Yeah, I think it's a very classic cycle that if you look at history, warfare becomes very regimented and becomes very rule-driven for a while. So in medieval Europe, up until, you know, the Industrial Revolution, 16, 1700s, warfare was very, very almost gentlemanly. You showed up on the field, you all lined up, you agreed when to start, and then you went at the war-making until... That didn't work anymore because some folks decided to break the rules and sneak around in trees and, you know, and go behind you. And that's happened over and over and over. So I think there could be a period in time where we sort of formalize war to the point where it's like, oh, okay, we'll have an arena and we'll have our insect horde fight your insect horde until somebody decides, you know what, I really want to win. I'm going to send my insect horde into their country and kill them all. In fact, somebody pointed out Web7382. And a couple other people pointed out there was a Star Trek episode where two planets had decided not to conduct physical war anymore, but just agree to simulate the war. And then to make sure that it was, you know, it had some punch to it, anybody who was deemed dead in the war by the computer had to go to the suicide machine and kill themselves.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I actually kind of remember that. But it's so fascinating, this idea that we would somehow agree to sit down and essentially play a large version of chess. And that was good enough. Like, what, you know, when do humans get over this need to conquer or win or take power or have power or maintain power enough to say, yeah, we'll just solve it all with this sort of giant chess match? And I don't know if it's in our nature. And I don't know if we get to a point where we evolve past that, and at least maybe not given, you know, the next 5,000 years or something. Maybe we need more time than that. But I love the idea. I love that it's about skill. It's basically, we basically turn war into a giant NASCAR race where it's all about the skill of the driver and how well your car is maintained and how much money goes into making sure it's race ready and all that sort of thing. And I love the idea. It just becomes such a competition then without any real consequence other than, I guess, financial. And what happens if you lose? All right, so your giant robot army, let's say Europe is now one big unified superpower and it's us in South America and Canada, and we're the two opposing forces, and we have a giant island we built out in the Atlantic, and that's where we fight this out. And let's say we lose. Well, then what? What was that fight for? Now they get to do what? Come over and take our robot factory in case someone else comes along and wants to challenge them? I mean, it seems like the stakes are weird in this scenario. And
tonight we're playing for Michigan.
Right.
Yeah. Will we be allowed to vote for who gets to play, like for the best players?
Oh, now that's interesting. It's a democratized army.
Like politicians, you know, we kind of vote for them. So
yeah,
I think it would become this whole American Idol thing.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Sure.
See, American, I like that. But army. See, what you guys are describing sounds kind of awesome, but I have to keep reminding myself, well, no, this is war, and war means death, and it means destruction, and it means, you know, loss of things, property, and life. And I just don't. I'm more interested in maybe the Olympics go away as we know them now. Forget about that stuff, and now it's just giant robot competition.
Well, you know what? That's interesting. I think there's two, and it's much more complex than this, but I'm going to identify two main purposes of war. One is an outlet for our tribalism. Our side is better than your side, right? And our group is stronger than your group. And I think sports and the Olympics and football actually provides a very safe outlet. We've developed that to sort of redirect some of that just bland, like, I want to go conquer somebody today, not for any good reason, just to prove that my tribe is better. We kind of channel that through sports now. And I could see sports becoming very robot-oriented, et cetera. But that doesn't satisfy the need of control. Like, I want your country to be a democracy, or I want your oil resources and access to them. I think we are moving away from nations wanting to run everything because nations realize that that's way too complicated and costly. They just want client states to do what they tell them. And that's where robot war is a lot murkier for me. If I send my robots to your arena and they fight,
and you decide, okay, so your robots beat me, I'm still not giving you the oil, then I got to send my robots in and kill you anyway. So it becomes a lot more complex then.
Yeah. Nobody works on the honor system in war. It's been my limited experience in war.
Well, and Scott, you mentioned, you know, when do we get past war? I don't know if you guys have noticed, but a lot of the science fiction coming out now is all dystopian. There's not really much utopian science fiction out there anymore. There's not like people dreaming of the Star Trek universe where we figured it all out and we're not using money anymore and, you know, everybody's fed and clothed. That's just not happening. And I think that comes a little bit from, you know, kind of dark times that we're in right now.
I think that's cyclical. At least I kind of hope it is. I'm a fan of Star Trek's vision of the future and our ability to sort of, you know, be cohesive as a human race and then kind of go out and fight the same struggle, but now as a single body and against others who haven't perhaps been enlightened or whatever. At least that's the general idea of Star Trek. And I've always sort of subscribed to it. But it is a cycle there where, and you're right, I think that society in general, at least its perception of reality, whether it's really reality or not, and Tom and I have talked about this a bunch of times on the show about living conditions are actually better than they've ever been, yet, you know, people think everything's going to end. And maybe that's partly why. But the idea that we could, you know, see our science fiction go from sort of dystopian to utopian and then back again, I don't think it's all that unusual. And in fact, I'll bet you money that we're on the bottom and then sort of working on the upside toward a more utopian use of our imagination when it comes to science fiction and whether
and
or not that reflects reality.
Dark fantasy is also pretty really popular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that all just comes kind of, you know, goes back and forth and it's actually a good thing that it does. I think it stretches us and stuff like that. But hopefully the thing we actually really are shooting for is the Trek version of things. It doesn't have to be just like Trek. You know,
shooting? But, really?
Sure.
You know, I want my transporter.
Well, we use that same term in photography, okay?
Yeah, that's okay. Fair enough. You're right. I'm sorry, Scott. The vision that we're killing for is peace.
Right. Yes.
All right, let's move on to the predicting. All right, folks, you can do some predicting. Send us an email like Airwolf did here, Airman Wolf. Email forecastpodcast@gmail.com or post them up at our blog, forecastpodcast.com. We'll take a look at them there. We'll start with you, Patrick Hester. Your vision of the future, sir. Lay it on us.
Well, there's lots of things. I was thinking about publishing because I do a lot with authors now. And I was thinking that it'd be nice in the future. I'd like to see the publishers kind of put their heads together in a way similar to what the WC3 has done and take back control of distribution of their books and provide a standard format for ebooks. Because it feels like we're in a little bit of a format war similar to Blu-ray versus HD DVD or Betamax versus VHS, really, if you want to go that far back. And I'd like to see publishers come out with a format and then the e-readers use that format instead of us having, you know, 20 different formats for ebooks. That way, if you buy a book, you could read it on whatever e-reader you decide you want to buy. If you want a Kindle, you can read it on a Kindle. If you want the Sony reader, you can read it on that. Rather than each of these manufacturers defining the format that you're going to read the book on.
Well, they do that in part because they want to control the ecosystem that feeds the readers. So they don't necessarily want to make all their money on the readers. They want to make a ton of money on the back end, which is, you know, Amazon wants to sell the books in their proprietary format, and Apple wants to sell them in their modified ebook format or EPUB format, and everybody else kind of wants to get that part of the business. And I understand why they do. I also really like what you're saying, but it's because it's a bit like, say, gasoline. We all have cars. They all use the gas. Let's get the gas in the same. It's not like we have to go, you know, choose a brand of car and then go, well, now, do I want their brand of gas? Because I don't know if I do. It's a little different because market conditions are different in the automobile industry and the way oil works and stuff. So it's kind of a bad analogy. But I kind of get where you're coming from. I just don't see how any company whose profits and shareholder interests are going to allow them to not try, at least try, to be the back end, to not just make iPods, but to also provide iTunes music store so you have to buy music through them, or a million other examples, right?
But look at cell phones. If you want a better analogy, in America, you buy the cell phone and you also get the contract. Outside of America, you can buy the cell phone independent of the provider, and you can just plug in a SIM card. And if you want to be on Verizon, you're on Verizon. If you want to be on Virgin, you're on Virgin. I'd kind of like to see that kind of a model here.
Yeah, well, I would for phones for sure. Chris, what do you think about this idea that we, you know, what if the pictures you took only worked on the digital photos you took only worked on certain computers because of the brand of, camera you were using? How terrible would that be?
I would hate that. I would really hate that. I think there are photographers who would like that if it was made into a very good business model for them. I mean, Apple is doing something like that with the App Store, and it's a pretty good business model for the app publishers. But and if someone comes up with something like that for photography, I think there would be photographers who would like that. But I want my stuff to be seen by as many eyes as possible, so I would want to be locked into one system or one platform for sure.
Well, that's the key, right? There are standards. There's lots of different standards. In fact, the EPUB standard is a very good standard. But if I buy a book, even if it's EPUB, from the iBook store, it doesn't necessarily work on the Kindle because of the DRM involved. So it's not just the format. It's also the digital rights management. What we found out with music is that eventually, if the music industry dropped the DRM and just said, all right, we're pretty much going to go with MP3s or AACs because they both play on everything, suddenly everything opens up and they have a chance to make a lot more music. The pressure there was that people wouldn't commit to an ecosystem because they were used to taking their music with them and re-listening to it elsewhere. And it was always a problem to say, now, wait a minute, if I buy all this plays for sure Windows DRM music, I can't play it on the Zune? I got to buy it all over again? Well, that's crazy. So now we've gotten rid of that with music, and your music is portable. You can take it with you. And now we're starting to see cloud services develop, et cetera, et cetera. The problem with books is there's not that same pressure. I buy a Kindle book. I read it once. Maybe I'll read it again someday, but I'm not going to run into that roadblock right again. So the motivation for the publishers to develop a standard isn't as imminent. Patrick, can you think of something that will push them to do this? Like what will force their hand? What will make them realize, hey, it's actually in your best interests to have cross-compatibility? DRM or not, but just have it so that when you buy a book, you can read it on any reader.
That pressure is already starting to build. And the reason being is Amazon's controlling the price. And just like with music, like you were saying, you know, the music industry has jumped onto Apple and iTunes thinking that just like everything that came before it, this is going to fail. They didn't expect it to work. They didn't expect anyone to embrace it the way they did. And what happened was Apple taught people that a single song is worth 99 cents. And when they taught people that, the music industry, they about crapped their pants. Because they said, well, wait a minute, 99 cents. No. We need to charge more. You know, they didn't expect it to explode the way it did. And the same kind of thing is happening with the Kindle. You know, Kindle sales are exploding and so many people are using it. Heck, my mom is 70 years old and I bought her a Kindle and she's reading two books a week now. Where before, you know, she would read like a book a month. But now, because she's got the Kindle and she can zoom in and see the words, you know, really big on the screen, it's easier for her to read. And she's just zooming through books. And the cheaper the book, you know, it's just like with iTunes. 99 cents is quick and easy. It's cheap. You don't have a problem clicking that button and saying buy. And before you know it, you spent $30 on songs. You didn't buy the entire album, but you bought all these individual songs. Well, the same thing is happening on Kindle. People are—it's so quick and easy to click that, you know, one-click button, and have it delivered to your Kindle. And Amazon is setting the prices, and I think that is what's going to spur the publishers to take back control and say, "Well, now wait a minute, you know, we know what we want to charge, and you're teaching people that you know a 99-cent ebook is a decent price." And you've got a lot of authors out there going, hold on, don't sell my stuff for a buck. I can't live off a buck. And I think that is going to be a really huge factor in all this. And I feel like we're only at the edge of this kind of format war. I think the big salvos are still to come.
Yeah, and the more and more we'll see less and less. Well, I don't know. We've talked about this before too, but the idea that the books will be less and less available in printed form overall. Now we'll always, you know, we're going to, for a very long time, we're going to see bestsellers and other books just constantly be available in print. But at some point, it becomes a time where it is not cost effective, even for mid to larger size publishers, to not just go straight digital when there's enough infiltration in the market of these devices, regardless of format. It just makes more sense for them to consume it that way because maybe more people are consuming books that way. That will have a lot to do with this. It'll also have an impact on cost, probably drive them lower. At least there may be some resistance on the publisher's part at first, but eventually I see, you know, cost of a digital ebook being lowered because you're not having to do minimum 50,000, you know, print,
right,
and you're not having to deal with all that anymore. Suddenly it's a one-off thing. You really don't have to make any. You have one and you distribute it to everybody. And that changes, I think that changes that dynamic quite a bit. And I think that's a big part of why music has settled into this 99 cents is a good deal thing, because you are having to print less, you press less CDs and distribute to less stores. And the stores sadly aren't as numerous as they used to be. And I think that's the same path we're on with books. But I agree with Tom. It is a slower decline. It's a much different. You know, there is not the instant sort of need or requirement that we figure this out now. And I think that's probably bad for you and I as consumers, because I think we'll be long gone before the real impact happens. But I think it will come eventually.
And, you know, I've talked to a lot of editors on sfsignal.com and on functionalnerds.com when we've done the podcasts. And a lot of them think that your normal paperback book is going away. They're going to keep the hardcover. They're going to keep that trade paperback. And then an ebook will replace that paperback book. But what's interesting to me is that that paperback book is, you know, anywhere between $6.99 and $8.99 retail. But they want to sell the ebook, you know, upwards of $10.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a real price pressure from amateurs and self-publishers who want to sell their books for 99 cents and publishers who want to sell somewhere between the current paperback and hardback prices for the ebooks. Mm-hmm. And then the distributors, and then by distributors in this case, I mean the e-reader makers like Amazon and Nook, sort of wanting to play both ends against the middle. You know, they want that publisher money, but they also want to get that long tail of self-publishers. Chris, do you see any parallels here with photography? I mean, it's an entirely different way that people make their money off photography than books, where you're out there, you know, selling directly to the consumer public.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of photographers who do that through stock sites, but we're mostly talking micro stocks here nowadays. Also for photography, where they came up with all these readers for books, and it's all those kind of almost dedicated devices, even though that's kind of changing now. But for photography, there's always been devices out there called monitors, called iPhones.
Screens, yeah.
Screens in general. So photography, I don't really see it to be that parallel at this point.
Yeah, because you've got a tool where you create the thing that is of interest,
yeah,
right?
Like, and there's also more, at least in what I do, it's more of a direct contact between the client asking me to do something specific. I don't know if a lot of clients hire a writer to write a book for them, whereas a commercial photographer will be hired by companies to create whatever imagery for their new advertising brochure or something.
And you do see some watermarking being done in photography, but the whole, yes, rights issue is an entirely different conversation than it is.
It
in
is
writing.
A different conversation, and I'm a fan of the Creative Commons license. I do have commercial work that doesn't go online, and I have a lot of work that is online in a limited resolution, so that it's not of use for certain applications. But the most of that is under Creative Commons. Non-commercial Creative Commons, and I love my work to be seen on other websites as long as I get a link back to me, some form of attribution. I would not like it to see it to be ripped off in a commercial way, like someone printing T-shirts of things, for example.
Sure.
Well, and a lot of times on the stock photography sites, they have multiple licenses, and you have to pick the one for whatever you're going to use it for. So if you were going to do I do this all the time. If you were going to use one of Chris's photos for a t-shirt, they usually have a license for that, and you have to pay a little bit more for the photo.
Right.
Before we move to Chris's predictions, Patrick, I just want to ask you, do you think that publishers survive? And if they do, what are the services that they provide to authors in the future?
This is a hot topic amongst some of the authors out there. There is a well-known author whose name I will not repeat, who I sat down with him, and he basically said that he believes that authors are going to have more power to negotiate with publishers moving forward, and publishers are going to have to come to the table with more offerings. The old model, I think, is going to go away, and I think that the publisher is going to have to say, here's what I can do for you, Mr. and Mrs. Author. And this is why you should go with me versus going to Kindle on your own. And what those services are going to be, I think, is going to be marketing. It's going to be, it's kind of hard to say copy editing, because you can go out and you can hire a copy editor. Whether you hire a good one or not is a completely other discussion. But I think that they're going to have to lay it out there and say, marketing, distribution, full-on editing, cover art, all that kind of stuff. We're going to take it. Essentially, we're going to take your book and we're going to push it through the system for you, and we're going to make life a little bit easier for you. And I think that is going to be the selling point for a lot of publishers moving forward.
Yeah, I think a lot of authors don't want to deal with the business of publishing.
Oh, yeah.
They don't want to go through all of the things you have to go through, even on a CreateSpace or a Lulu or something like that. And so having a publisher that'll do that for them is very attractive.
I forget her name, but there was a decent fantasy author who was doing pretty well. And there's a lot of pressure now on authors to do more marketing. They want you to be on Twitter. They want you to do blogging. They want you on Facebook, taking advantage of all the social media stuff to build an audience. And this author said, that's not what I want to be. I don't want to be that person. I want to sit in my basement surrounded by my posters writing stuff and just send it out there and not have to do all that kind of personal appearance marketing stuff. And she walked away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are a lot of authors out there who don't want to mess with this stuff.
Just control their own destiny, right? I mean, they want to have more say in what their careers are. I not only totally get that, I really support that. I think that's if that's the way things are moving, I say more power to the authors and less slightly to the publishers. Let the publishers, do what they do and let the author do what they want to do.
Yeah, there's a definite appeal to the author to be able to go to Amazon.com, log into their account, and know that next month they're going to receive a check for blah. And that's something that they don't necessarily always have that they can count on with a publisher, mm-hmm. depending on the publisher. A lot of publishers do really well with that, and they send you reports and they let you know where your money's coming from and when it's going to come in. But there's also been a lot of horror stories from authors who said, I never know when I'm going to get paid. And so there's definitely an appeal to taking control of your own destiny, doing it your own way. But you also have to remember that you're going to be doing all the work yourself. And there's a lot of people out there who don't want to do that.
I think there's a big opportunity for a new kind of publisher to move in right now and say, I will allow you to have all the benefits of self-publishing without all the hassle. And my customers are going to have the benefit of my curation as a publisher, that you're going to get good books and good authors from me. And I'm sure there's a lot of publishers already moving that way, but I could see a Richard Branson backed Virgin Publishing that does something like that. Maybe not Richard Branson, but that's sort of disruptive. I'm surprised someone hasn't moved in and done that. I think Amazon is sort of taking tippy toe steps towards that, but they don't want to piss off the publishers that are providing all the books to their Amazon store. So they don't want to go too hard against that. They've already got their books banned out of the Barnes and Noble stores with what they've done so far.
Yep, I saw that.
All right, let's move to you, Chris. Your predictions, your take on the future. Share it with us, if you will. Thank you.
Well, it's obviously going to be something around photography. And I've been thinking, how far do I want to go into the future? And I was thinking of things that I think are pretty close, like tapping into the optical nerve to take pictures and these kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
But that I didn't feel that was enough. So... Let's go a bit further. Wow. First of all, is photography still going to be around in the future? And I'm talking, I have no idea, maybe 1,000 years, maybe 3,000 years, if the human race is still around at that time. And first of all, I think, yes, still photography especially will still exist as, I'd say, as an art form. People will still want to make art. But I believe that the way that's going to be made will be very, very different. And now I have to stretch your imagination a bit. Imagine that everything will constantly be on record. Maybe not on a molecular level, but on a more coarse resolution level.
On a very high number of megapixels level.
Sort of, but imagine that capture to be a three-dimensional capture.
Okay.
Over time. So you have a constant, 4D recording of everything. And now what you could do is slice and dice that four-dimensional thing any way you like. So all visual forms and more, and that goes way beyond photography, will be derived from that record. And it all happens via computation. So if you look at something like a still picture, that's just going to be sliced through time. Through that matrix thing, and you get to choose the perspective. You get to choose where you are, choose the focal length, choose the depth of field. You even choose the time when you take that picture, or when you decide when this picture is going to be taken. So, the concept of a decisive moment is gone. And then if you look at video, you just leave that time axis in. You'll be able to freely choose your perspective with this kind of a system, which means that. That would even serve as a perfect source for any 3D that you could imagine, mm-hmm. including holographic environments. And we are already seeing a few of these things. There are cameras out there that will take pictures, a series of pictures, and you get to choose the best one, or maybe the camera will even try to choose the best one.
Yeah, Lightro is kind of a step down this path, isn't it?
Lightro does refocusing, but you could also do this with this kind of system. Mm-hmm. Refocusing would be inherent in that. But also the time at which you take that picture. Cameras are already in the process of giving you that choice within like a 5-second range or something. Resolution. Look at Kinect, for example, or look at today's handheld 3D scanners that you just pass over something and they will come up with a 3D image. Just add better resolution, add color, and you basically have that kind of a system.
Add basically infinite bandwidth and those sorts of things. I actually think this is pretty likely, but I want to throw this back at you from the perspective of a photographer who you know makes his living as a photographer. Does this not? It reminds me. I hate using this analogy, but it reminds me of the whole reason Syndrome was trying to take out the Incredibles in the Incredibles movie. All right. Stay with me here for a second. So the whole point was, if everybody's super in the future, then no one is. And in a future where every possible angle, every possible depth of field, every possible everything is recorded in this constant sort of snapshot of every nanosecond of life, doesn't it essentially mean, because now everybody can do all of that kind of tweaking, subtle change, whatever, all the things that the photographers are so good at now with their natural talent and their skill, suddenly you're left without any of that, right?
Look at what happened in desktop publishing. I mean, everyone all of a sudden had a word processor, and there was lots of cool word art and lots of really ugly stuff out there all of a sudden. So you will still need that person to have the vision, to have the idea of what looks good and what's art and what isn't. Also today, I mean, we're already kind of going there. I mean, everyone has if you buy a DSLR these days, you have a professional tool no matter at what price point. You can do really professional work. So the whole democratization of that of photography is already there. A lot of professional photographers don't get the money they used to get because now your client will just hand this job over to his nephew. So we're already there, I think. We're already there, and everyone will be that artist in the future, but there will still be like individuals who are better at seeing from what angle that thing looks good and with what light and at what depth of field. You still have to call these shots and make the decisions because the system, unless it's really deeply in your brain, will probably not know what your intention is with the picture. So it'll do its automatic stuff and it'll just come up with something that might not be what you really want to
You could sort of
might not tell the story that you want to tell.
You could sort of see this effect in Instagram a little bit, where you unintentionally have a controlled experiment. Everybody's using the same phone, same camera. There's not a lot of room to change the focal length or do all the things that you do in professional photography. But some people take amazing pictures that they post up there, and then there's me. So you, I mean, I'm not just being self-deprecating. Like I avowedly admit I'm not very good at taking pictures, and you know, having have the same equipment as other people doesn't make me any better. And I think it's all about the eye. It's being able to find that perspective and find that moment and find the light and say, that's what I want to do with it. And that's the tweak I want to make with it.
It's kind of the same with podcasting. It's the same with art. I mean, I kind of threw the question out as a hypothetical because I'm living the current day example of how if you give enough tools to enough people and it's the gateway is wider and less expensive to get into that gate, you give really talented people an opportunity to shine and rise to the top. But what you do create is a big wad of average as well. And so I don't disagree at all. I think you're totally right. It's just you are still going to have more than you even do now, because you're right. Now people have in their hands great cameras. Most people's phones that they go buy today have pretty good cameras built into these things, and you can do some pretty amazing work, like Tom's saying, on Instagram or otherwise. And but you so you still have to be, all right, well, now there's a big sort of a larger average pool. I've got to sort of still rise above that and be better than everybody else. And it's true of anything. You know, we 20, 30 years ago, if you'd have said, well, let's just start our own radio show. Holy crap, Tom, the hoops we'd have to jump through, the pain it would be, the gateway to get through would have been nearly insurmountable without a very traditional path and a much narrower gate and a much smaller group of key holders. And that's all changed now. So I'm all about this idea that you can, you know, these things now open themselves up to everybody, but it's still an issue of who is going to harness that and be amazing, you know, and not be average.
Yeah, I find the greater the tools, the harder it gets to become really good. And we see this, the more possibilities you have, the harder it gets. And constraint is really where creativity strives. Just last weekend, I've been out just with the iPhone, with the purpose to shoot pictures, to do photography. I deliberately left the big cameras at home, and the pictures I took home were, from a technical point of view, maybe not as perfect, but from a creative point of view, much better than a lot of the other stuff that I do.
Yeah, well, it's why a lot of people like to draw or shoot black and white photography or post on mm-hmm. Twitter. It's all the same thing. It's a constraint that I'm working within.
Yes.
And your prediction eliminates constraints. And yes, so you're right. It makes it much harder to be like, okay, you can take any view at any point in time with any light exposure. Now I have no more excuses. You know, it's direct to my brain. Patrick, what do you think about this?
I think we're partway there already because of our iPhones and our smartphones. Everybody has one of these. Everybody's taking a bunch of pictures right now. So we're partway there. But I don't know how far it'll go. I don't know if we'll actually hit all the 3D kind of stuff that Chris is talking about. You know, I know that Sprint has a 3D phone right now. And my joke was that, you know, what that's going to do is usher in a whole new age of homemade porn.
Well, that's always the leading edge of any technology, right?
Right.
Right. Well, because now it's coming right at you. But, you know.
Literally.
Ouch.
I just think with the way these are changing and the way that these have better and better cameras in them, people aren't taking cameras anymore. You know, I had to do some Christmas shopping for a company that I was working for, and they wanted me to go out and buy a bunch of technology. And one of the things that they specifically asked me not to buy was a camera. And when I said why, they said, well, no one uses cameras anymore. They all have their phones. And I thought that was a very interesting statement. But I think Chris is right in that you still need that eye. You still need that person who has a talent for what they're doing to make good art. When we talk about the publishing again, we talk about how anybody can go out now and publish on Kindle. There's an author who told me, you know, get ready for the slush pile. Because what happens is there's no longer any gatekeepers between you and some of the bad stuff out there. And that's where we're at with photography. You know, there's a lot of bad stuff, but there's also a lot of good stuff. And what the apps on these things are doing for us is they're taking away some of the need to have talent. Does that make sense? And in other words, now it's just, you point it and you click it and it does all the hard work for you. But you can tell that it's doing all the hard work for you. You know, I think when someone like Chris takes a picture, they infuse a little bit of themselves into that. You know, there's a decision being made. There's a feeling as part of that. And so I can't see that going away anytime soon. But the 3D thing is interesting. You know, like right now, you know, my niece and nephew have more photographs of them that have been taken than were ever taken of me growing up. Because, you know, my mom had a little Polaroid.
Yeah.
And by the time the kids rolled around, it was all digital stuff. And you know, it's just like you have no problem snapping 1,000 pictures because the storage is also another thing. You don't have to physically store photos anymore. You know, again, this phone has more memory on it than my first computer.
Yep.
And can store hundreds and hundreds of photos.
Yeah. Right. And a good typewriter has never made a good author. The tool is never... Right. Really, the thing that makes it.
That's interesting you say that. I deal with this all the time, and maybe this anecdote is helpful for some, but I get asked constantly about my illustration work, and people say, well, what tablet do you have? And I always say, well, now I'm using a Cintiq 21UX, and it's fantastic, and I love it. And they all say, you know what, that's probably what I need to get. I feel like I need a boost to my skills. I think maybe a new tablet is the trick. And I have to always kind of say to them, tablets are awesome and they're nice and they really help clean up on paint issues and running out of ink and a lot of other issues are sort of solved with tablets. But it doesn't change the fact that you need to be able to draw. If you can't draw, that tablet is useless for you. It doesn't do it for you. It will never do it for you. And the day it does do it for you, we've got some kind of weird implants in our heads that somehow tap into talent we didn't know we had. And until we get to that day, you've still got to know how to do the thing that you got to do. And for authors, that's true. And for everybody else, that's true. So yeah, this conversation is such a great one about the individual and his ability to find new ways in modern technology to do stuff we couldn't do before. And if he's got the talent for it, then the cream rises to the top every time. I think it's something it seems like we've all agreed upon right here on the show.
Yep. If you want to go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead, Chris.
If you want to insult your photographer friends, just tell them you take great photos. You must have a great camera.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that every time I talk to an author and I do an interview with them on the podcasts, there's almost always the same comment made. You know, it's like, well, I worked really hard to get where I'm at. There's no shortcut.
Yeah. Well, right. Yet. I mean, gene therapy is doing amazing things, but...
Yeah.
Don't want to go down that rat hole.
Whole nother show. No.
Yeah. Yeah. Technology can't solve it for you. All right. Shall we get to four questions, Scott?
We shall indeed. Four questions is the part of the show on Forecast each and every Monday where we ask our guests four questions rapid fire style. They are not allowed. It is enforced. They are not allowed to think too hard about this.
We'll be shocked.
You have to answer from the gut. Exactly. You will be shot in order to maintain peace. All right. So let's start with my four questions. These are going to be to Patrick. Patrick, are you sitting comfortably?
I am, yes.
Which do you prefer? Really good-looking aliens that want us all dead, or really stomach-churning, ugly, smelly aliens who want to be our friends?
Oh, I'm going to have to go with the really good-looking aliens that want us all dead.
All right. They'll be pretty while it lasts.
Femme fatale.
Good job. Next question. If you could go back in time and buy stock in one company, who would it be?
Apple.
Yeah.
What is this, past cast? What is this, time travel back in time?
I don't know what I'm doing. Sometimes you got to shake it up. In the vegan uprising of 2043, you didn't see that coming. There's a future for you. In the vegan uprising of 2043, what will be the best way for meat eaters to protect themselves?
Shield yourself with cows.
Smart.
There's a herd of cattle. Great idea. Because they won't come near them, dude. That's great. Like vampires. All right. Last question. No offense to vegans, by the way. Hold your emails.
Yeah,
I'm just playing around.
I have a lot of vegan friends. Yeah,
I do too. My daughter's a vegan. It's vegans are great.
You're just tweaking your daughter with that question, is what you're doing.
Basically, yeah. And she's not a very good vegan. Anyway, some say the moon is made of cheese. What food item do you think Saturn will turn out to be made of?
Spam.
There is a ring around my spam. Fantastic.
Saturn,
you have
musubi.
Nice job. Tom, over to you.
All right, Chris, are you sitting comfortably?
Well, you got to cut me some slack. It's almost 2 a.m. here, so I'm a bit slow.
Absolutely. No problem. That we'll begin. The first question you've almost answered with your prediction. This is the question I'd written. Drawing, painting, photography, videography. What will be the next advance in the visual medium?
Well, the record, the big 4D record.
Yeah, the everything record. So you kind of already answered that. So I'll throw in an alternate question one. Will we ever be able to photograph vampires?
Just with an anti-mirror.
Uh-huh. We just need the technology. Nice. All right. Question number two. Will humans always be at war, or will they outgrow that need? We talked about this earlier, too.
Well, they will replace the shooting with guns by shooting with cameras.
Aha. Uh-huh. The photo wars begin. Question number three. Which will we achieve first? Faster than light travel, teleportation, or the shedding of the need for our bodies?
The letter. Advances in technology will make that possible.
We forget teleportation, forget spaceships. We'll just
plug in and
float through
the matrix. Be in the matrix.
Yeah. Question number four. When will we first observe intelligent alien life, or will we ever?
I don't think we will, because everything's too far away. Stuff travels too slow.
So it'll never catch up with us, distance.
Not in our lifetime, maybe in 1,000 or in 2,000 years.
All right.
But not now.
So we just have to have the singularity happen soon, and then we'll wait it out.
By the way, one thing about the vegan question earlier, as a vegan, you cannot be a film photographer because film is made with gelatin.
Oh.
And there's no good substitute, huh?
There is no real substitute for that right now.
But how many photographers are still using film?
I do, for example.
Yeah, I think a bunch do.
Yeah,
This is one of those constraints I was talking about earlier. Shooting with film puts you under so many constraints that you have to become creative. So I shoot most of my non-commercial work is what I shoot for myself is on film, actually.
Interesting. I didn't know that. I didn't realize that. I think I knew that some film was made in gelatin, but I didn't realize there was no other way around it. That's it.
Well, it's a plastic thing that the gelatin is on, but the silver crystals are embedded in gelatin.
You can't make it out of human nail clipping gelatin or something?
I don't think so.
There's no really. Cottage industry for that.
Probably not. Well, Kodak used to have its own gelatin production.
Yeah.
Tom, it's a tough sell, you know? Kodak getting up and going, now made with human fingernails. It just doesn't have the same ring.
It's one of the reasons they're bankrupt.
Hey, Tom?
Yeah.
Tom, on the question about the robot bodies, I think that that's going to come first. But what we don't realize is that when we do plug into those bodies, they're only going to have a 2-hour battery charge.
Oh, dang it.
It's always the batteries. We'll never solve that. That's
and you have to sign a 2-year contract.
Yeah.
Permanent wireless charging.
Someday, please. Thank you. All right, that's it for this episode of Forecast. Thank you so much. This has been a really fun one. Patrick Hester, thank you. Let folks know some of the many podcasts you're involved in and where they can find them.
Well, you can find me online at atfmb.com. That's all things from my brain. That's also my Twitter handle, atfmb. And then functionalnerds.com is the podcast with John and Elio. And sfsignal.com is the podcast I do twice a week talking about science fiction and fantasy stuff. And then I produce I Should Be Writing for Merle Lafferty, which is the podcast for wannabe fiction writers.
Excellent. And I had a great time on the Functional Nerds podcast when you guys were nice enough to ask me on. So
yeah, that was a blast.
Go check it out, functionalnerds.com and atfmb.com for all the rest of Patrick's stuff. Chris Marquardt, a pleasure as always. Good to talk to you again as well. And let folks know where they can follow you and find out what you're up to.
Well, I think the only thing I want to plug is the workshops I do. I will come to the United States and to Canada in August and September this year. And you can find them at discoverthetopfloor.com. It's an entire list of cool, fun topics to learn photography face-to-face and to learn these skills, to learn what your machines won't do for you.
Ah, it'll be good to see you in our hemisphere again.
I'll drop by.
Excellent. Sure. Looking forward to it. ChrisMarquardt.com or what's the...
discoverthetopfloor.com.
Discoverthetopfloor.com. Check it out. Thanks, everybody, for watching or listening. Scott Johnson, anything we need to get across before we let you go?
I would just say that Tom had a brilliant idea that we have acted upon post-haste. If you are a World of Warcraft fan and you are sad you can't go to BlizzCon this year, Tom and I and many others in the Frog Pants Network will be hosting a big weekend streamathon where we will try to make up for the lack of BlizzCon. It'll be free. Donations will be taken for charity. And it will be a cavalcade of stars, streamed matches of actual games being played competitively and otherwise. It's going to be fun. It is called BlizzCon 2012. You can find details at theinstance.net, and I think people should come. It's going to be a blast.
Yeah, if you don't realize, there's no BlizzCon this year. Blizzard just said, we're not going to do one this year. It's not that we'll never do one again. We're just not doing this one this year. So this is the way of our way of filling the gap.
It's going to be fun.
Thanks, everybody, for watching.
Do you have to wait in line for 8 hours to listen to the podcast?
Yes, absolutely.
No. And you don't have to smell bad or any of those things.
You have to stand in line.
As you can tell, I've been to BlizzCon.
Yeah, no kidding. Don't forget to leave comments at our website, forecastpodcast.com, or email us, forecastpodcast@gmail.com. That's it for this episode. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
But it's only 32 years away.
Great episode. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, you guys were awesome. No, thank you.
Chris, thank you would never know it was like 2 a.m. in Germany. That's crazy.
No.
Yeah, I was having lots of sauerkraut and sausages before I came on. That keeps me awake as a German.
Yes, of course. Well, cool. Thanks again for staying up for us.